Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how might big history change our thinking about the role of humanity in the history of the Earth and the convergence of science and religion? But first, how most of what we buy and consume helps prop up dictatorships and systems of oppression, and some ways to start changing this. With us is Leif Winar. He's chair of philosophy and law at King's College London and author of the book Blood Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Run the World. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Leif Winar. It's great to have you here with us.
Thanks so much, Maria. I'm glad to be here.
A fascinating book, Blood Oil. You have traced the making of so many of our things, really, in fact, just about everything that we use, built upon these natural resources in multiple places, all pulled from Mother Earth. You open with the mobile phone. Do you want to walk us through a little bit of that first, and then we'll expand that into other things?
It's true. You know, these wonderful devices that we carry around with us that do so much for us, that we text with and talk into and game on, we don't tend to think that these are all natural resources, and the natural resources come from specific places on our Earth. The thing about the natural resources that go into our phones is that on the other end of the world's supply chains, there's often something called the resource curse. It's a fact about our world, which is surprising, that countries that are very rich in natural resources are often full of very poor people and authoritarians and militias and corruption. The resource curse is a serious problem in our world, and that's what this book is about.
So let's go into a description of the supply chain that you did in the book. You had a beautiful description of it that is really connected to everything we wear, everything we use, and each of these has its own supply chain. Can you walk us through some examples?
Sure. So if you think about the circuitry in your cell phone, well, where did the molecules to make up that circuitry come from? Probably from all over the world. It could be that somewhere, say, in the solder of your circuitry, there's some tin that came from the Congo, and it might have gone from there to a smelter in Thailand and then manufacturing plant, perhaps in China, and then shipping all through the world supply chains to where you are. That means that whoever took out that little piece of metal from the ground at the other end of the world is in business with you, and you are sending some of your money back to them when you buy products like a cell phone or other electronics, a laptop, game station, whatever it is. Because of globalization, we are in business with people all over the world, and the surprising thing is that especially in places that have a lot of resources, we're often unintentionally in business with very aggressive and violent and repressive people who are selling off the natural resources at the other end of the supply chain.
Now, you said this is even things like the clothes we wear.
That's right. I hate to say we think that we buy a lot of oil when we pay at the pump, but when it comes to oil, in fact, the biggest of all natural resources that's traded across borders, we're buying oil all the time, even when we don't think about it. So if you buy any clothes that are made with artificial fabrics, you're buying oil. And I just going to say anything that is plastic is made out of oil. And it's not only that. Oil is in the creams we smear on our faces, in our cosmetics. It might be in our shoes. It might be helping your sex life. I mean, oil is everywhere in our lives. And we pay for oil all the time, which again means that whenever we go to the checkout, we may be sending some of our dollars and pounds and euros to men who consider themselves to be our enemies.
And you use this phrase, say, the resource curse. How exactly would you explain what we mean by the resource curse? You would think it would be a blessing.
You would. And in some countries, it is a blessing. I can explain what the difference is between the countries that are blessed and cursed by natural resources. But just to get a sense of how bad the resource curse is, especially for oil, the big resource, I can put it this way. You can think about all the great progress that the developing world has made over the last generation. I think of the great rise of China and India and South America and even many parts of Africa, but not the oil-producing countries. The oil-producing countries in the developing world are no more rich, they're no more free, and they're no more peaceful than they were even in 1980. That's remarkable. In these countries, oil is not a blessing, it is a curse.
And it is a curse because?
It's a curse because of one very old and very bad law at the international level that we take entirely for granted because it's been around for so long, but which is causing a tremendous amount of trouble in our world and that we now need to reform if we possibly can. This is the rule in all of our countries that say we will buy oil and other resources from whoever in other countries can control those resources by force. So if an authoritarian regime can keep a country under its cosh, we'll buy the oil from them. If a militia can get some tin out of the ground at gunpoint in the Congo, well, it'll be legal for us to buy that tin eventually from them. Our rule, the rule of the world for resources, is might makes right, and that's what puts us into business with these aggressive and oppressive actors overseas.
Now, is this rule essentially embedded in international law, or is this an unwritten rule?
It's an unwritten rule, and if you're an international lawyer, let me just say that there is nothing in international law that requires us to use this rule. So we are all sovereign countries, and we can make our own rules for who we think we should be buying resources from. Now, the rule that we use now, we've used it for a long time, we take it for granted, but if you think about it, it makes no sense. I mean, Marie, if you and I get some guns and go take over a petrol station down the street, no one thinks that you and I should get the legal right to sell off the gas, the petrol, and keep the money. But if you and I got some guns and took over the government of Angola, the next day you and I would have the right to sell the oil of Angola to all importing countries. So the rule of might makes right makes no sense when you think about it. It's a rule that we all use, but it's a rule that all of our countries have the right to change, and we should change it now.
So let's back up just a little bit and get more into some of the details that you laid out in the first part of the book as well. And then I'd like to come back to this, particularly as we talk about ways in which this whole process can change. But I'd really like to give a sense of how intertwined this whole thing is and how deep it really is. And maybe one place to start digging a little deeper is how much of these natural resources do we use? You described how much aluminum and steel and wood and copper we use as a humanity. How can we get an understanding of the scope of this?
It's hard. You know, there are more than 7 billion people alive right now, 7 billion human beings, each with the desires of every day to consume, to work, to have a house over their heads. The resources we use are just gigantic in their scale. So if you could imagine a gigantic block of iron crashing down on the ground once a second, a block of iron that weighs 50 tons, that's how much iron the world uses every second. And with oil, it's even more. It's hard to get a sense of how much oil we use right now. Put it this way, the world uses 1,000 barrels of oil. That's 42,000 gallons of oil every second. You can just imagine the 3 Olympic-sized swimming pools full of this black goo disappearing in a shower of tiny sparks every second. 90% of the world's transportation works on oil. Almost every plane, train, car, boat, it's all oil-powered. We don't think about it much, but the world, humanity, uses gargantuan amounts of natural resources every single second of the day.
And you've said in your book in the early pages that this is actually more than just being addicted to oil and that there's more to it.
We are addicted to oil. It would be hard to keep 7.5 billion people alive right now without the oil. And let me just say, to solve the problem of the resource curse, the oil curse in particular, we should get off fossil fuels as quickly as we possibly can and get onto alternative sources of energy. But that's going to take a while, because we do need this combustible mud to keep our transportation systems going right now, and we use natural gas to heat our homes and to make electricity and so on. So we have to transition away from fossils. We have to cure ourselves of our addiction to oil, but it is going to take a while. And the other side of the addiction is, of course, the countries that have oil. There, it's not that the people are addicted to oil so much as the leaders are addicted to our money that we pay for oil. So we get the oil, we send our money in to the Saudis, the Iranians, the Qataris, and so on, and they use our money to keep themselves in power by buying the muscle and the loyalty they need to divide and rule. So they're addicted to our money just as much as we're addicted to their oil. It's a mutually assured addiction, and that's something we really have to stop because it's so dangerous.
And it's a little bit paradoxical, too, this idea that these resource-rich countries are actually in some ways becoming less peaceful and more poor when you look at the population as a whole, while many states that are not oil-producing, they're getting richer, they're getting freer and more peaceful. How do we explain this?
So here is the big fact that everyone can remember. Oil is the largest source of absolute power in the world. In our world, because we say might makes right, whoever can keep coercive control over oil wells will get a big funnel full of money from the world as it was just coming down from the sky. They can use that money for whatever purposes they want, and in non-democratic countries, sometimes the money will go to a militia like ISIS or these militias we've seen in Libya. They can use our money to buy more weapons, to pay for more soldiers. And sometimes our money goes to an authoritarian regime like we've seen over the years with Saddam and Gaddafi, or now still the Saudis, who have used our money not only to repress their own population, but also to spread this extreme, intolerant version of Islam around the world that we now see mutating into jihadi extremism, not only in the Middle East and Asia, but also in the West. So oil is a tremendous source of unaccountable power in our world, and that's why it's so dangerous, not only to the people of the oil-producing country, but eventually to us too.
One of the things you point out is that it seems like it's almost inescapable that we as consumers cannot be part of this. Now, on one hand, we don't see the devastation when we go and buy a new blouse or a new pair of pants or a new pair of shoes. It just looks like a perfectly legal transaction. But you say unless we buy our food in an organic Amish farm, really our shopping is saturated with oil at every stage. So what about the individual consumption?
You know, there are ways that consumers can help to convince our leaders to get us out of this terrible business of buying blood oil whenever we go shopping. There's a website called Clean Trade, cleantrade.org. And if you go to Clean Trade, you'll see there are strategies that consumers can use. For example, at Clean Trade, there'll soon be an index of the big oil companies. You can check which ones are doing more business with authoritarian regimes. And when you need to fill up your car with petrol, well, you can go to a company that does less business with authoritarians. There's also some boycotts we can use to help convince our Chinese friends not to buy oil from these authoritarian countries. Consumers can help to put pressure on our leaders to change this business that we're in, but eventually it has to be a political change. We do need to change our own laws in our own countries to say all of the people in our country will no longer be in business with these aggressive and oppressive actors overseas. We just don't want to buy oil from those guys anymore and send them our money with which they're causing so much trouble.
Now, in terms of foreign policy, you noted that, yes, while there's so much power wrapped up in the oil industry and these supply chains, these oil companies are not quite as influential as we tend to think they are. It sounded like you're a little bit more pluralistic in showing that there are these multiple influences, including geopolitical considerations, but you mentioned even the small NGO can make an impact.
You know, it's really funny, Maria. I've been getting more optimistic over the past 10 years as I've been doing this research about the changes that can be made even against very powerful actors. Now, big oil companies are doing what they do, and they've done a lot of questionable deals overseas, and they are very powerful at home. But if we're convinced that we need to make a change, we can win battles. Even small NGOs have won big battles. Let me give you an example of that. Everyone in this part of the world knows that we need more transparency around oil. It's totally opaque to the people of oil-producing countries how much their government is getting for the oil that's being sold off. But, of course, the big oil companies did not want to be more transparent about the deals they were making. There was an NGO over here that convinced a couple of American senators that it would be a good idea to have more transparency in the oil industry, and they produced a bill which went nowhere at first because oil was so strong. But then the window of opportunity came, and it happened to be that terrible big oil spill you might remember in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. It was a terrible spill, but the silver lining was that that summer, the oil industry's lobbyists couldn't get their phone calls returned in Washington because oil was just toxic. The senators reintroduced their bill, and it passed, and it required all American oil companies to become more transparent. And the really inspiring thing about this story is, once the United States required transparency of its companies, well, then Europe put in the same requirement, and Norway, and now Canada, and there's a real movement throughout the West to require that transparency of oil companies. We didn't think we were going to get that for 10, 20 years, but now it's law in all of these countries. Progress can happen if we have our stuff ready to go. The window of opportunity will open.
It's interesting you just mentioned Norway, and you mentioned Norway in the book as well as an example of a resource-rich country that is not the resource curse. Why is that?
So this is what I mentioned before. There is a distinction between countries where resources are a blessing and resources are a curse. Norway is doing so well with its oil. You can imagine that the pension funds there are filled for decades in advance, and it's very good on gender equality, public services. Norway is doing spectacularly well with its oil wealth, and why? It's because Norway was a country where the government was accountable to the people when the oil first came in. When the government is accountable to the people, then of course the people forced the government to use the oil money for public goods. And that's when oil can be a blessing. The oil money goes to strongmen or militias. That's when oil can be a curse. And that's why we see such troubles in this arc of oil from Russia through the Middle East into Africa. That's where oil came in, where the government was not accountable to the people, and that's where the curse sets in so severely.
So that's the curse on the side of the human effect. Of course, we're also simultaneously dealing with the climate effect, which would imply that even when oil is a blessing on the human effect in the case of Norway, it may still be a curse for the planet's overall health.
That is definitely true. And as I said, we should get off fossils as quickly as we feasibly can. We just have to do both of these things at once. I mean, think about the big stories that came out of Paris last autumn. One story was the climate negotiations, which were at least a bit more hopeful than Copenhagen had been. And the other story was those terrible attacks in Paris by ISIS operatives. We just have to try to tackle both of these problems at once. The growth of climate change, the spread of violent extremism, they're both difficult problems. But the movements can work together. The best strategy really is an autocrats to alternatives plan for energy for all of our countries. We can work together and get a win-win solution on energy for both.
So let's keep going down this solution path that you've been laying out. You were talking about the international rule, and you've talked about this idea of effectiveness.
Effectiveness is the fancy lawyer's word for might makes right. So this just is the bad old rule left over from centuries ago that says we will buy oil and other resources from whoever can control it by force in other countries. So, for example, when Saddam Hussein took over Iraq in a coup, the world started buying oil from him. And then years later, when ISIS took over those same wells, well, the world made it legal to buy oil from ISIS. Our default rule is effectiveness. It is might makes right. And that is what's driving violence and oppression overseas. When we say the most coercive men in a country will get our money, well, then, of course, the most coercive men will fight to get on top and use our money to stay on top.
Are there any constraints in international law or none at all?
No, we can change our own laws on our own soil for our own people. And in fact, the really hopeful thing is that we don't have to invent any new or international organizations. We don't have to sign any new treaties. All we have to do is get our own country's laws to line up with principles that we already deeply believe in. The big principle is just the intuitive one that we believe already, which is a country belongs to its people. Right, a country belongs to its people. Over here in America, Abraham Lincoln said it in his inaugural address. A country belongs to its people, and that means that it's the people, and not just coercive power, who should have the ultimate right to say what should happen to the resources in a country. That's a principle we already believe. Leaders around the world already speak this language. A country belongs to its people, the oil belongs to its people. And best of all, there are already major treaties signed where it says, in Article 1 of both the Human Rights Covenants, for example, all peoples shall, for their own ends, freely dispose of their natural wealth and resources. So the bad old rule of effectiveness might makes right is causing all of this trouble in the world. And the better modern rule that all countries belong to their people is already deeply embedded in the global culture. Leaders talk the talk. The treaties are already signed. We just have to align our own laws with this principle we all already believe to make progress against might makes right.
And that would be country by country, you're saying?
That's right. And any country can be a leader in this regard. New Zealand certainly is well-placed to be a leader. New Zealand could go clean trade tomorrow by passing an act saying, we will, on a certain date, no longer be purchasing oil from any government which is not minimally accountable to its people. And I do mean minimally. You don't have to be Norway to sell oil, you know, with the consent of the people. It's basically just asking, can the people find out what's happening to their resources? And if a majority strongly dislikes what the government is doing, could the majority stop what the government is doing? Minimal civil liberties and political rights. If a government is not accountable to its people in that minimal extent, well, then by our own principle that a country belongs to its people, we shouldn't be buying that oil.
Is this what you are calling the clean trade framework?
That's right. Clean trade is the framework, and I said cleantrade.org is online. It really is a couple of laws. We should just pass a law saying that peacefully, deliberately, gradually, we are going to taper off our imports of all authoritarian oil, and then we'll pass a second set of laws to try to encourage the big Asian importers, for example, like China and India, also to announce that they will be stopping buying authoritarian oil at some point in the future.
I know you're advocating for minimizing our use of these non-renewable resources, and you use some examples in the book about how much depletion there really is on these non-renewable resources. And I think you used Cyprus as an example, a country that used to be rich in copper and now has nothing left. Are we facing at some point what used to be called peak oil? Are we facing a complete depletion of this natural resource?
Anyone who tells you that they know what the future of oil is very optimistic. Predictions about oil are notoriously difficult. And when I started this book 10 years ago, the talk was of peak oil. We would soon run out. And then the shale revolution started in the United States, and now peak oil is not much talked about. The thing that's almost undeniably true is that we're not running out of oil so much as running out of cheap oil. The easy oil in the world is draining down, and the oil that we're now accessing is harder and harder and more expensive and more environmentally dangerous to extract. So we're not running out of oil, but we're running out of cheap oil, and the oil that we're getting is much dirtier to extract. So it really is time to start transitioning away from fossils to cleaner sources of energy.
You know, you make another interesting point. The United States is an oil-producing country at this point because of the fracking and the shale oil that you were just describing. Would you call it one of these resource-rich countries?
Sure. The United States is a major energy producer. It has been for a long time. The energy of the United States, especially the fossils, powered it through the 20th century, helped it become a great economic power. Oil, other resources in the United States are very significant in their absolute volume, but as a percentage of the economy, they're quite small, maybe 2-3% of GDP. It's about the same as restaurants, say. So oil in the United States, other minerals, it's not a big part of the economy, and that's why, along with being democratic, oil doesn't curse the United States very much. It's a similar story in, say, Canada, the UK. Australia, as you know, has enough natural resources that it did better than other Western countries during the recent financial crisis. So if you have a moderate amount of resources as part of your GDP, well, then resources can contribute to the economic activity. It's really when you get most of your economic activity coming from oil, especially if you're non-democratic, that's when trouble starts to set in.
So let's now look back at the solutions that you're proposing, for example, the laws that could be enacted in the purchasing countries. Is there a downside to refusing to buy from these oil-rich, resource-cursed countries in which people, even the very poorest, may be desperate to have even pennies from? Or are you suggesting that it will force these dictatorships to reform?
It will encourage dictatorships to reform. If they're losing their customers for the oil, then there will be a more responsive government in power before long. But about the people who are poor in these oil-producing countries, you know, I take this so seriously, and I've studied this quite a bit. In order to convince yourself that we need to change the way we do business for oil and other resources, you just have to look at the resource curse seriously. I mean, look at that statistic that I gave you not so long ago. Oil-rich countries are no richer than they were in 1980. That's a remarkable fact, and there's a great deal of extreme poverty in many of these oil-producing states. You can think of the big ones in Africa, in Nigeria, Angola, and so on. Angola, there's a fantastically rich, corrupt regime living extravagant lifestyles, while it's also the worst place in the world to be a child. It's the highest child mortality rates in the world in Angola. So oil, other resources in these countries, in general, is not helping the poor. Really is an impediment to development in so many places, and that's why we have to make the governments more responsive to the people of the country, do everything we can to encourage governments to become more responsive to the people of the country so that the people can get more of the benefits of the natural resources of their country.
Leif Winard, thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
It's been my absolute pleasure, Maria, and I thank you so much for having me on.
The name of the book is Blood Oil, Tyrants, Violence, and the Rules That Rule the World. Leif Winard is the Chair of Philosophy and Law at King's College London. When we come back, how might big history change our thinking about the role of humanity in the history of the Earth? Stay tuned.
The drumfish, they beach themselves in Harukari. The blackbirds, they fell in thousands from the sky. Their red wings streaming down from the higher seas, deflected by the ground. They crown the sun, they crown the sun,
they crown the sun,
they crown the sun,
they crown the sun.
But I believe that they are free when their time was done.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How might the approach of big history change our thinking about the history of the world and the role of humanity in its shape? With us now is history professor Jonathan Markley. Markley teaches big history at California State University Fullerton, and he's hosted a series of television programs on the subject. Welcome to The Scholar Circle, Jonathan Markley. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to start with this concept of big history. How would you describe big history and how it's distinct from what other historians do?
Big history is the ultimate in macro history, when you're really trying to zoom out and get a handle on everything that's going on. There's a lot of metaphors that have been used, but one I rather like is that of aerial archaeology. So traditional archaeology, you're on the ground, you're digging in the dirt, you're sifting through every little piece, looking for a bone, looking for a coin, finding the foundations. But then on the other hand, if you get in a plane and you're high above the desert, you can suddenly see patterns that would be invisible at a lower level. You can see where the highways go. You can see, oh, suddenly we're digging in a palace. This is part of a larger structure. So it's not something that could ever replace traditional archaeology, but at the same time, without somebody looking at the bigger picture, it's hard to really get a full understanding of what's going on.
So you've got the big picture, you're talking about archaeology, but it seems like what you do is more from the entire history of the planet.
Very true. The original concept or idea of a big history course was when David Christian, a professor at Macquarie in Sydney, was just in a history department meeting, and he sort of just threw an idea out to his department. Wouldn't it be great if we could have a history course that actually started at the Big Bang and went all the way through to the present? And his colleagues all looked at him and said, good idea, why don't you do it? So that was where it was born. So it does certainly have a lot of overlap, because the early part has, you know, physics and biology and chemistry. But it does go right through up until the present. And I think actually it's one of the fields of history that actually does give you some hope of having at least a little bit of predictive power into the future. Everybody always says, you know, you need to study history in order to understand where we're going. But most of the time, historians are pretty shy about attempting to do that.
I understand that Microsoft founder Bill Gates is now funding this, I guess we could call it a big history movement, to teach this in schools. What do you know about that?
Well, again, this is something that came about through David Christian, who's sort of the guy who coined the term. He was actually working in the same Cal State system as me, but down in San Diego, and he made one of those Learning Company DVD series or CD series, you know, where people can buy them. And it turned out, little did we know, that Bill Gates is a big fan of history of science, and when he's in the gym on the running machine, he listens to these sort of recorded classes. And he listened to this one by David Christian, thought it was rather good, and then got his secretary to give David Christian a call. And when you hear David tell the story, it's quite funny. He says he was having a really bad day. He picked up the phone and said, "What?" And he said there was this very nice young lady at the other end of the phone who said, Mr. Gates would like to meet you. And David said, well, he knew the answer to that question. So anyway, long story short, they met up, and Bill Gates said he wanted to fund the development of all the materials and all the tools and the assistance to set this up as a high school course. And that's the Big History Project. And it's still being funded by Bill Gates. It's still entirely free. All the resources are there. There's some really good resources where the teachers sort of get together and give each other advice, showing how they can fit it into traditional curriculum. They've got schools doing it in Australia, in Korea, quite a number in the United States. So it is something that's gradually been spinning up. They're up to, I'm not sure what the latest count is, but I know it's several hundred schools at least.
So in addition to teaching and researching, you've also been doing some television. And one of the episodes that I saw dealt with science and religion. And you said you had come across a document from the Catholic Church. What was that document, and what does it mean for these two paradigms?
The particular document you're referring to was Pope John Paul II. And he was addressing the Papal Academy of Sciences. And they were taking as their topic of study the question of human evolution. Now, normally, people immediately hear church and evolution and assume they must be in opposition to each other. But, in fact, the Pope was saying then, and he was building on some of the writings of earlier popes, where he said the Catholic Church is, in fact, very interested in this question because they want to know where human beings came from. And they have no problem at all with the concept that human beings could be created out of pre-existing biological material. So in other words, you could have an evolutionary process that would lead to human beings. But of course, their doctrine still maintains the concept that there is a significant difference between humans with a soul and animals that don't. But the idea that human being could emerge through evolutionary processes was something that the Catholic Church has no problem with.
You've actually argued that religion is a bit of an attempt at what you're calling big history. How do you see that?
In the early days, well, not just early days, the big history has been called a creation story. And the idea there is that every human society that has ever existed wants to have a creation story. They want to know where it began. They want to know how it developed, and they want to think about where it might end up. So in that sense, the Big Bang Theory, the expanding universe, the solar system formation, and the ultimate fate of the universe ties in with a very deep human need. It's one of those interesting things, again, which you see when you zoom out on a wider scale. If you look at every human society that's ever existed, every single one's had a creation story. So, you know, if we discovered some new island somewhere in the Pacific with a human tribe that had been out of contact with other humans for 10,000 years, we could predict certain things about them. And one of them is they would have a creation story. So in each case, they're building on what they know. So you can't have a theory about where things come from if you don't have a certain amount of knowledge. Like, for example, Big Bang cosmology came about initially because some of the discoveries by Hubble and various other instruments, there was sort of no possibility of developing a theory like that until you had a greater understanding of how the universe operated. So if you go back to these periods where a lot of these religious creation stories were created, they actually make a fair bit of sense based on what knowledge was available to them at the time, which is really all sciences as well. We are taking all the knowledge available, building hypotheses that explain everything we can see, and as we discover new things, our hypotheses have to be modified. And I think in that sense, you could call the early religious creation stories hypotheses for how the universe developed. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, and so what you're saying is there's actually some common ground between religion and science, but there are probably also equally important some big differences, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. A big difference, I think, with science is that it is built into the very concept that the story will change over time, that as new discoveries are made, these will be altered, while the most religious creation stories tend to have become, I don't know, calcified, I guess is the term I'd use, where they no longer change and no longer evolve and assume that the creation story as told must be the final truth. And so, of course, scientific method requires that new discoveries be incorporated and theories be altered as our understanding of the universe changes.
So this is one of many what you call false barriers, it seems. For example, different disciplines acting as silos and not talking with each other.
I can tell you've been reading some big history literature. As soon as you use the word silo, most of modern science has depended on the separation of subjects. So we have departments of chemistry, departments of biology, history, anthropology, etc., etc. And that's absolutely necessary because you have to have somebody who focuses on some tiny little aspect and becomes a world expert on that and then advances our knowledge. But this is also sometimes a problem because chemistry and biology are not really separate subjects. They're dealing with the same material. They're dealing with different aspects of the same material. So sometimes you get these artificial barriers that actually inhibit knowledge. So again, it's not right to say that it's a bad thing that knowledge is separated like that, but at the same time, we have to understand that that introduces artificial barriers. Well, I remember a fascinating piece I read where there was a chemist saying that the question of where life comes from to start with is not really a question of biology, it's really a question of chemistry, because all the theories say that you have inorganic material that somehow or other must assemble to become organic material that becomes life. So the question of how do you get life is a question of chemistry, not biology. But it's only because we separate knowledge between biology and chemistry that we even see that there is this barrier that has to be discussed, that one is part of the other. You have organic chemistry, inorganic chemistry. Biology depends on chemical processes and physics and the movement of electrons. Photosynthesis depends on the way sunlight affects the electrons in the plants. And these subjects can't really be separated. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense to see things more as on a continuum.
Yes, exactly.
At one conference, I think you argued that consciousness or intention plays a much smaller role in human history than we think. How do you explain this?
Yes. The idea that human consciousness and human decisions is far less important than we realize, well, I really came to this conclusion by studying the process of domestication of animals. Normally, we just assume this is something humans did to the plants and the animals. Humans came along and decided, I'm going to domesticate this animal, and then perhaps they capture a baby animal, they raise it in captivity, and thereby humans domesticate animals. But the physical evidence for the process of domestication of things like wheat and pigs and other animals actually doesn't support this idea. It takes thousands of years for these processes to develop. So, for example, with wheat, one of the processes that is associated with domestication is the encouragement by humans of non-shattering seeds. So normally grass spreads its seeds on the wind. The seeds will ripen, a strong wind will come along, the seeds will fly away and land wherever they will. Humans come along and they domesticate the plant, and suddenly you no longer get the wind shattering seed pods. Suddenly the seed pods are staying on the grass stems and humans are harvesting them. So it sounds like something that humans did. Generally, the literature and the descriptions of domestication, humans selected it, humans thereby created this. But in fact, what was going on was there were certain mutants within the grass species where the seed pods never shattered. So humans came along and started as hunter-gatherers and started gathering seeds in that field. And which seed did they gather? They didn't gather the seeds of the non-mutants because they had blown away and they were no longer there. Humans came along and started gathering the seeds that were still stuck on the grass stems, which, of course, were the genetic mutants that couldn't reproduce on their own. Now, with hundreds of years of humans following the same migratory patterns as hunter-gatherers, always returning at the same time of year to the same fields, gathering those same grass seeds, they thereby encouraged those seeds to reproduce because they took them off. Some of them dropped on the ground. They started growing. And then you have a biological divergence between the wild version of the grass, which spreads its seeds on the wind, and the domesticated version. So in that sense, yes, humans did it, but there was absolutely no conscious intention to do that. The only thing the humans did was something which was very animal-like. They knew to come to the same field every year to gather a food source that would be present and ripe at that exact time of year, and yet because they do that pattern of behavior year in and year out for hundreds of years, gradually a version that we now call domesticated wheat emerges. But there was no decision to do that. It was just a natural evolutionary process, I guess you'd say.
So a bit of serendipity. And
yes.
Also, I think you described it at that conference as kind of a co-evolution, much like squirrels in certain trees.
Oh, absolutely. This is another one which I really like, up in Northern California, visiting the sequoia trees. So in the case of the sequoia tree, the sequoias depend on squirrels to reproduce. The squirrel wants to get the seeds the sequoia tree is growing, and without the squirrels going after the seeds, none of the tree's seeds will hit the ground, and therefore the sequoia won't be able to reproduce. We have a co-evolutionary pattern here. Now, we wouldn't say that the squirrel domesticated the sequoia any more than we'd say that the sequoia domesticated the squirrel. And the processes that developed between humans and animals and plants were much more akin to that. So, a really good example of this is the cat. People can relate to the idea that cats domesticated themselves. So humans settle down for agriculture. They start building granaries and having lots of waste in their villages. Naturally enough, mice and rats come to their villages. Therefore, animals that hunt the mice and rats also turn up in the villages. And now we have cats. Cats start hanging around human beings. They have a long process of many hundreds of years of just growing used to each other, becoming habituated to each other, as the language is. And gradually over time, the two species grow together, humans and cats. Nowadays, we talk about it as domestication, but anyone who's had a pet cat really knows that the cat is only sort of semi-domesticated at best. Now, it always seemed to be the case that cats were sort of the exception and all of the other animals were much the same. But what we're increasingly coming to realize is that almost all the other domestication events happened in a very similar way. So, for example, wild pigs started hanging around human farming communities because human farming communities were producing a lot of waste that they could access. That when you plow the field, you're digging up lots of roots that the pigs would like. So again, it seems to be the case that the pigs started hanging around human communities simply because humans were creating an environment that was beneficial for the pigs. And you see that gradually the shape of their teeth alters over the course of several thousand years, simply because the pigs no longer had to dig up roots from deep in the ground, so they didn't need those stronger teeth anymore. And only after several thousand years do you see an abrupt change, and we can tell what that is. That's when humans actually start managing the pigs and feeding them and giving them human waste. We can see from their bone samples and all sorts of other things that suddenly we have domestication. So the parallel I like to use there is actually those classic stories you see on so many love stories where there's a girl who likes a guy, but she doesn't want to make the first move. So she sets up lots of positions until eventually the dumb guy wakes up and finally gives her a kiss. And thereby everybody can say, she says, he says, the guy made the first move. But in fact, all of the pre-positioning for that to happen happened completely unconsciously as far as the guy was concerned. And that's really closer to what the domestication of these animals was like. 95% of the work was already done before humans actually seemed to sort of wake up to the fact, here we have these animals hanging around our communities, we could actually start actively managing them. It is a mutually beneficial relationship, just the same with fields of wheat. Again, we don't think of the wheat being an active participant in this alliance, but you think about what a human farming community is. Humans slave to make sure that more of the wheat grows than anything else. And then human beings build storehouses to store the seeds and protect them. They kill any competitors in the fields. We call that weeding. They introduce fresh food. We call that fertilizer for the plants. They introduce additional water supply so that grass can grow in areas where it normally would not be able to grow. And the human communities that succeed the most are the ones that actually help the grass grow the most and help them reproduce year in and year out.
One of the questions you're putting forward is who is really domesticating whom?
Absolutely. My studies of big history, and particularly the study of grass and the domestication of animals, has really fundamentally altered the way I see the rise of humanity. The traditional narrative is, you know, there was an old TV documentary called The Rise of Man. It's all about the rise of one species. But when you zoom out and look at it from a broader point of view, you actually see it's really the rise of an alliance. There's human beings, there's quite a number of different plants, but wheat and barley, corn and rice and plants like that are the most prominent. Then there are several animals, there are dogs, there are cows, there are sheep, and we all rise together. It's the rise of a multi-species alliance as opposed to the rise of a single species. There's so much stuff going on right now that involves harnessing the power of bacteria and viruses for our own purposes. I would actually see this as part of exactly the same process. It's a new wave of domestication. It's taken this level of science for us to get to that point where we can realize there's a whole other layer of life on Earth, and we're starting to form a whole bunch of these alliances with a bunch of bacteria species. A great example of this is the way they're already using viruses to combat food poisoning. So there's a particular virus that attacks the Listeria bacteria. So in supermarkets today, you'll sometimes see somebody going around spraying what looks like just water spray on the fish in the supermarket butcher deli section. What they're actually spraying on that fish is a virus. They're not going to promote it as a virus. They call them bacteriophages because, well, that sounds a lot nicer. And that virus is killing the bacteria that makes humans sick and enables those fish to stay on the supermarket shelf so much longer. There's other examples of bacteria that they're harnessing to potentially start making fuel for us, producing penicillin. There's another one where they're playing with the genetic makeup of E. coli to get it to attack one of the bacteria that contributes to pneumonia. So, in fact, right now, we're going through a whole wave of a new kind of domestication.
Since this is kind of tied into intention and consciousness, as we started to talk about this in those terms, one could argue, of course, that part of it is unconscious, like part of the development, this kind of co-evolution that's happening probably within the genetic level, but that part of it is also conscious, even among the other species.
One thing I should stress is that when I talk about the lack of intentionality, that's usually in the early days of human domestication of plants and animals. Of course, by the time you get up to early modern Europe, you start to see really conscious breeding of animals. And today, with all our understanding of genetics, human beings now have fully jumped into the driver's seat, and they're consciously setting out to produce desired traits. That was some of Charles Darwin's most interesting observations. He was looking at racehorse breeding, pigeon breeding, and these kind of things, and that largely shaped his understanding of how these processes work, which is also probably why for so long we've always thought of it as being about conscious intention, because in the modern world it really is. We really are in the driver's seat now. But, of course, that also means those organisms are benefiting as well. One of the things that really changed my thinking about how the world works was one of the chapters in Jared Diamond's books, Guns, Germs, and Steel. In that book, he was talking about viruses and what works for a virus. Now, we always automatically tend to assume, at least I know I did, that the virus wants to kill us. The virus is our enemy. And it was only reading this chapter, and he was explaining that, of course, a virus doesn't actually want to kill its own host. The virus wants the host to live. So when you look at the evolutionary process of a virus over the long term, they tend to get less deadly. It tends to be the new viruses that wipe out large numbers of humans. And as time goes by, those viruses actually adapt to become less and less deadly. The perfect virus is a very mild flu that leaves you feeling well enough to go into work, so you can then cough on all your workmates and spread the virus to everybody else. So in that sense, we have other organisms that are using humans for their own benefit, but also their priorities are not necessarily the same priorities as ours.
You had written this history of the world from a different point of view. You said from the dominant species, and it was a non-human perspective. What is the dominant species?
Since I've been studying the history of grass, I thought, could I actually write a piece whereby I argued that grass was the dominant species on the planet and not humans? Why would I argue that grass was the dominant species? Well, if you go back and look at the history of the last 10 million years or so, you see that grass actually reshaped the planet in very much the same terms we tend to limit to human influence. So, for example, the spreading of the great grasslands, the prairies and the savannah and the Russian steppe, the Australian grasslands, is a relatively new phenomenon. The grasslands spread and dominated about 20% of the land masses. And as a result, when we study the fossil record and the teat records, we find that they utterly shaped the makeup of the animal kingdom as well. So species that could live well in grassland environments thrived and grew. Species that didn't live well in grassland environments simply went extinct. In every single case where a major civilization has emerged, there's always been a grass in the picture. So in China, it was millet and rice. In the Middle East, it was wheat and barley. In Central America, it was corn. Even in South America, where they had the potato, corn was still playing a pretty important role. And so you can actually go as far to say, if there's no grass present, you don't get human civilization. So you get a picture emerging whereby you might say humans are the apex animal in the relationship and grass is the apex plant in the relationship. And only when those two species come together do you get the whole phase that we now think of human history and civilization and all the rest. And human beings essentially become slaves of the grass. We spend vast amounts of resources, especially in the agricultural world. 95-98% of all people were involved in producing and preserving and processing those grass seeds, like wheat seeds and barley seeds and rice seeds. And if they succeeded, then the human species succeeded. If they failed, then human communities fell apart and you had war and anarchy and chaos and Malthusian collapse. And even today, it's our ability to produce enough wheat and barley and rice and corn around the world that enables us to sustain this modern world.
You wrote the piece arguing that humanity went from being free creatures to being indentured servants here.
We did. For example, anywhere in the world, when humans move to agriculture, they get weaker and more unhealthy. Their teeth rot, their bone strength and muscle mass reduces, their lifespans get reduced. In virtually every case, the move from being hunter-gatherers to agriculture made the life of an individual human much worse off. The way it helped us was our numbers were able to increase massively. Perhaps pre-agriculture, there might have been as few as 5 million human beings in the world, and pre-industrial revolution, that grew to about a billion people. But the average wealth or energy available per person never really grew. You have to wait till the Industrial Revolution before that really shows any significant improvement.
What does this tell us really about humanity?
If you ask me what the main thing about big history concerning our understanding of the world, it's brought me to increasingly think of human beings as part of the environment rather than separate from the environment, rather than the normal idea of you have human beings and you have nature as two separate things. It's really obvious to me now that human beings are simply one more dynamic in the natural cycle. Well, there's a sliding scale. Like, just one funny little fact, again, to make us realize that we're not quite as different as we like to believe, is the idea that human beings name their children. That's such a human trait. And yet, we suddenly find in the environment that there are lots of different creatures that have distinct names. We know dolphins give names to each other. We know that certain species of parrot give names to each other. And a recent study actually went and tried to work out, how does a parrot get its name? Is it somehow natural? Is it innate? Is it programmed in the DNA? And the conclusion they came to was, mummy and daddy name the baby. The baby will grow up understanding that's its name, and the rest of the birds will refer to that parrot by its name for the rest of its life. This is something that, until not that long ago, we would have thought, well, that's so purely human, and yet here we have a case where non-human creatures are doing the same thing. We are one more creature in the environment, perhaps a very interesting creature in the environment, one that's reshaped the planet in lots of ways, but we're not the only species that's done that. As I said, grass has done that as well. And we're also not unique or separated. We're part of the environment. We're of the environment. It's not humanity versus nature.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle, Jonathan Markley.
I had a good time. Thank you.
History professor Jonathan Markley teaches big history at California State University, Fullerton, and he's hosted a series of television programs on the subject. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.